Someone recently sent me an intriguing article entitled My Problem with the Bible, in which the author noted the perspective with which most of the Bible was written. The author said, actually a pastor said, one of the most remarkable things about the Bible is that in it we find the narrative told from the perspective of the poor, the oppressed, the enslaved, the conquered, the occupied, the defeated. We know that history is written by the winners. This is true, except in the case of the Bible, it's the opposite. This is the subversive genius of the Bible, and especially the Hebrew prophets. They wrote from a bottom-up perspective. Imagine a story of colonialism written by our First Nations people or by African slaves. That would be a different way of telling the story, wouldn't it? And yet, that is what the Bible does. It is the story of Egypt told by the slaves, the story of Babylon told by the exiles, the story of Rome told by the occupied. Stories of motherhood told by those who lived through the agony of motherlessness. Just think of Sarah, Hannah, Elizabeth. And this morning we'll look at a story of a widow who lost everything, including the hope of ever knowing the joy of being a grandmother. Now, there are several reasons why I've chosen to focus on this story on Mother's Day. Partly because a larger series that we're doing over the next couple of months, I'm calling it Perspectives. You saw the different perspectives in the Mother's Day video earlier on, right? All through the stages of life. And we glean different things from different perspectives. And we want to do that in different stories of the Bible. I was also challenged in an article that I read just over a week ago in the local paper. You may recall that about 3 years ago, there were two women that were killed on the side of the road by a drunk driver. And that just went through court and a sentencing. And just there was one line just that really struck me. A victim impact statement from one of the mothers. It said, I am a mother now, but I don't have a child. And that was just part of the emotional victim impact statement read in court by Mary Ogilvie, the mother of one of the women who was killed in February 2011. And she said, a little further on in that article, it said she lives every day in a nightmare since her daughter died. It felt almost like she would for the rest of her life. And it reminded me of other painful stories I've heard from mothers. I remember one who's divorced said, I never go to Mother's Day. I feel shame going to church on Mother's Day. Everybody's celebrating things, and I feel like my family's all broken. And what really struck me, I think, is that I felt like we need to hear a story of God's ability to bring hope and healing. Celebration, yes, but there's backstory. And so I've selected this morning a story, and I was especially reminded of this difference when we were at the BC conference. The camp, during the camp ministry, one of the camps especially shared, Pines Bible Camp. Some of you may recall 2 years ago there was the worst of all storms ripped through that camp. It destroyed almost all the buildings, vehicles, including one of the campers that was killed, who was in one of the cabins. And Gene Cron, the person who's been the leader at that camp for years, just gave us a brief window into what that felt like standing in the midst of everything broken, like all of the work just destroyed. Then he told us also a lot of hard work, but stories of hope and rebuilding and how they celebrated their 50th anniversary of the camp just recently in these new cabins and new facilities. And it was so beyond what he could have asked or imagined of what God had been able to do. But it was entering into the darkness of remembering the dark days of that made the brightness shine all the greater. And so I want us to turn this morning to the book of Ruth. It's in the Old Testament, the book of Ruth. Joshua, Judges, Ruth. And in my Bible reading, it was probably about a month ago, it's just this line jumped out at me. Because it was, I don't remember ever reading this line. And we'll read it in context, I'll tell you which one it is. But Ruth chapter 4, looking verses 14 to 18. Or first beginning of verse 13 to 17. If you don't know the story of Ruth, we'll get to that in a little bit. But it says here, it's coming to the end of the story. So Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. Now here's a Mother's Day moment, a Mount Everest Mother's Day moment that comes. The women said to Naomi, that is Ruth's mother-in-law, praise be to the Lord who this day has not left you without a family guardian. May he become famous throughout Israel. That is this new child, this grandchild. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons. That's the line. Your daughter-in-law, who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth. And then we have this picture of Naomi taking the child in her arms and, and caring for him. It's the picture of a nursing mother, actually. It's the closest possible relationship. And the women living there said, Naomi has a son. And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David, king of Israel. Now, it struck me as how they would say that she, now, you know the mother-in-law jokes, right? And maybe there's daughter-in-law jokes. And yet here, the daughter-in-law, they say, you're better. And there, this is a patriarchal culture. Now, to say that she was better than a son, like, that would be radical, right? But to say that she's better than seven sons, nowhere else do we hear this kind of excessive praise anywhere and doesn't come anywhere afterwards. Like, it's the Mount Everest of praise, if you will, of celebration. This is the pinnacle of Mother's Day moments. And it's like, wonderful. But it comes at the end of a story that would hard to believe where it starts. Remember the tale of two cities? It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. And using this was the best of times, but it didn't begin as the best of times. Just go back to the first chapter. It began as the worst of times. It begins in the days, it says, when the judges ruled. If you know anything about the Bible, it was the bloody and darkest days when the nation fell into moral anarchy, and it was warlords that ruled the day. And then it says there was a famine in the land. I mean, this was the most devastating of experiences. This put you on the brink of disaster and death. It made you basically, in a sense, unemployed, broken, humbled, and in despair. And a famine happens in Bethlehem. Hebrew, the names always have another meaning. Bethlehem is house of bread. A famine in the breadbasket. It's a terrifyingly common reality in the ancient Near East. Not only does it drive people from their land, it also forces them to mortgage it away, making this a matter of life and death. And so they leave the land. The land, that is the land, the promised land, the land of Israel. I grew up in close to Winnipeg. Whenever anybody said, oh, we're going to the city, it always meant Winnipeg, not Vancouver. Right here, whenever they just say the land, everybody knows it's the land, the promised land. And they're leaving that. And they went for a while, it says, to live or sojourn for a while in the country of Moab. And maybe it was the closest. Often people would go down to Egypt because they had the Nile and it would always regularly flood. Wasn't susceptible to that, but they'd probably go to the closest places. But you need to know that the Moabites were the product of an incestuous relationship, and there was a history of conflict between them and the Israelites. And by way of contrast, these Israelites were Ephrathites. That is, they were descended from Caleb, an aristocratic family, if you will, in Israel. A dynamic equivalent would be they were from the House of Tudor from London, England, and yet they were forced into survival mode as migrants and resident aliens in Moab. And then it says, and Elimelech, my God is king. That's what his name means. An aristocratic name. Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, it says in verse 3. To add tragedy upon tragedy, Naomi's husband dies, and within a decade, because it just quickly condenses the story, gives us the background in verse 5, we read that both of their two children, Malchon and Chilion, died. And again, you want a glimpse into what their life was like? Malchon's name is really weakness, like incredible weakness. And the other son's name means exhaustion, totally spent. They have had a rough life, okay? And now even weakness and exhaustion are dead. And then it says that Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. But in actual Hebrew, it doesn't even have her name. What it says is, and the woman was left. She doesn't even have a name. She has lost all identity. It is telling us she has lost absolutely everything. This is the most hopeless of all possible situations. And she will hear word, one word that there is, God has returned to his people in Bethlehem, and so she will go back. But when she goes back in verse 13, she will tell the people, they say, oh, there's Naomi. Her name means pleasant. And she will say, the Lord's hand is turned against me. And she says, don't call me pleasant, call me bitter, Mara. For the Lord has made, for I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. If we were to look at the other chapters, we would see the God of turning points. Not that they saw it, but they returned to Bethlehem. The word actually occurs 11 times in chapter 1 to get the point that even if they don't see it, this returning back to the place of God is a great returning. It's the possibility of new beginnings. She gleans in a field belonging to Boaz, it says, but in Hebrew it says, she chanced to chance. We might say it was dumb luck that she happened to go on a field that became a turning point because she met a godly person. But it's underlining, do you think this was luck? Do you really think this was luck, dumb luck? Or do you think there's a God who is able to transform even the most hopeless and despairing situations? And after a rather awkward marriage proposal that takes place in chapter 3, there's a story there of this Boaz character. In an age when everybody did what was right in their own eyes, of moral anarchy and warlords ruling, this godly person who says, no, stay among my servant girls, because if you go work in any other fields, you're likely to be harmed. And her mother-in-law underlines that. You're probably going to be abused, raped. Safety and security in the midst of an age of great tragedy and violence. And so we come then back to the epilogue, to the end of the story, and we come to this, it was the best of times moment. And we hear the elders that they're when they're married, the elders pray this threefold blessing over her in verses 11 and 12. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah. That is the original matriarchs of the whole nation of Israel, who together built up the house of Israel. May you, a second blessing, have the standing in Ephrath and be famous in Bethlehem, a person of great standing and significance. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. That is another pagan who was brought into the family of God because of what she did in terms of devoting herself to God and his ways and doing what was righteous. And so the blessing is, the hope is that Ruth will be like these great matriarchs and like another famous non-Israelite who brought great blessing. And the women of Bethlehem give us great threefold praise in the verses that we read. And the commentator says, this speech devotes itself almost exclusively to describing Naomi's restoration to life and fullness. The resolution is perfect. Death and emptiness have given way to life and fullness, a kind or type of resurrection. Notice that closing picture, right? Of this fulfilled grandparent enjoying her grandchild. You saw it in the movie clip, but a number of weeks ago, Marilyn and Clausen, on the Saturday, they had a new grandbaby. And she was over the top on Sunday morning. It was so exciting to see joy. And I thought of her when I was reading this passage about Naomi. How great her joy was. And she who was left alone without her two sons now takes the boy, holds him, and becomes the one who cares for him. And it's interesting, normally what takes place is that the greeting, the announcement of the birth would be given to the husband who would have been waiting and say, it's a boy! And what the writer does instead is he changes it. And he says, there's a birth announcement take place, and they come to the grandmother, Naomi, because she's been waiting the most. Her joy is going to be even greater than the father's son in this one. It's just underlining how this is the Mount Everest, if you will. And the story ends with the greatest surprise of all. This is no ordinary son, but the grandfather of the great King David, who becomes the standard by which all other kings in Israel are measured until Jesus Christ.